Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We appreciate you tuning in. We're going to start this hour talking about sex, when it's consensual, when it's rape. This week, in The Stranger, reporter Sydney Brownstone told the story of an alleged sex work scam in Seattle.
So, an online profile under the name of Deja Stwali reached out to multiple women online. This Deja Stwali Facebook profile was posing as a porn recruiter, and these were very young women, 19 years old, 20 years old, looking to get into porn as a way to pay the bills. So this woman, Deja, would reach out to them, say, "You have the right look. I'm a porn recruiter. I work for a number of indie studios, and it's my job to get women into the porn industry safely because I've seen them get into some sketchy situations that didn't turn out to be real. I exist because I know there are scammers out there. And I will put you in touch with my best photographer, Maddie. He's my ex-boyfriend. He's great. You just need to go over to his apartment for an audition." And so these women allegedly went to his apartment, and he allegedly told them that part of the audition was having unfilmed sex with him in order to prove that they could do it. Several of the women felt violated after, but they couldn't put their finger on why. And they never heard from any porn production companies after that. And this Deja Stwali Facebook profile has been reaching out to women since at least 2013.
You named this photographer in your piece. What does he say for himself?
I put all of the allegations in the piece in front of him, gave him multiple opportunities to respond. He told me that he couldn't say anything and that he had hired a lawyer, and under the guidance of his lawyer, he was advised to not say anything. However, he was willing to speak in more general terms about the stories themselves because the stories originated online. He said that some things flying around aren't true and that he thinks that the stories are weird and ridiculous. He also said that he had hired a lawyer in the, quote, off chance that this becomes a legal issue, which kind of startled me because it seemed like several accusations were building against him. And at that point, at least one woman had filed a police report. So I asked him directly, I said, "You're not concerned that this one woman has filed a police report?" And he said, "Oh, I am. I just can't talk about it."
So now a question is, if these allegations are true, is this rape? Because these women say they consented at the time, but that's because they thought they were auditioning and he could launch their careers or, you know, get them work. They wouldn't have slept with this guy if they hadn't been lied to. What's the law say about this?
Well, so I think we need to be careful about saying that they consented at the time, because I think they would say now that that wasn't actually informed consent.
Was not consent. That's the question.
Right. So Washington actually kind of has somewhat regressive laws when it comes to rape. In order for rape to be prosecuted in the first degree, the law requires forcible compulsion. That means someone holding a deadly weapon, kidnapping you, inflicting serious physical injury. Consent only comes into the equation for rape in the third degree. And prosecutors find consent cases more difficult because of, well, our culture, of the stigma attached to people who report rape, and then a stigma attached to sex workers or people looking to get into sex work specifically. So in order to prosecute this rape, you would need a prosecutor who's willing to approach that stigma, who wants to find justice for these alleged crimes.
But there are some states, Sydney, that have spelled this out in their law, right? That this would constitute rape, right? Consent obtained by trickery?
Yes, there are several states who have passed laws under rape by deceit or rape by fraud. And these statutes were motivated by a series of cases in which men would sneak into women's homes in the middle of the night. They would get into bed, and the woman, thinking that this man was a boyfriend or a husband, would have sex with them. And when the lights came on, they realized that, no, they had just been raped. But the laws on the books weren't capable of handling that type of situation. So states like California have passed rape by deceit laws.
But not Washington State.
But not Washington State. That's correct.
One of the objections to a law change like this would be the slippery slope argument that, well, boy, a lot of people misrepresent themselves before having sex. You pretend to be different from how you are and then have sex with someone. Is that basically the argument?
That is, and it's a good question to ask. At the same time, I would say that there's a difference between misrepresenting yourself to someone in an interpersonal relationship and saying, you know, have sex with me because I'm in a band, or have sex with me because I floss regularly, and telling someone to have sex with you because it will lead to a business opportunity. And Washington State does have laws on the books that prosecute fraud or misrepresentation of a business opportunity that one defense attorney and former municipal judge in Las Vegas told me could be potentially applied in this case. But the other discussion we should be having is that our laws on the books do cover, to some extent, consent. But I think this has been highlighted by the Stanford rape case. The number of rapes that actually get reported to police are a fraction. The number of cases that get turned over to a prosecutor or get turned into arrests are a fraction. And the number of convictions that result are a fraction. And then the sentencing on top of it is often light, especially for more privileged members of society, white educated men.
Well, you could see why women wouldn't want to go to the police about a situation like this. I was really surprised they gave you their names in your stories, didn't they?
Yeah, I was really, really floored by that too, because for so long, as you know, it's been journalistic convention to not use the names of rape victims. But I think that these survivors wanted to reclaim that space, and they wanted to reject shame. And knowing that silence is to some degree complicity in our society for crimes such as rape, they wanted to own it. I don't know if I could have made the same decision if I were in their shoes.
Sydney Brownstone, reporter at The Stranger. We're sharing a link to her story with you now on Twitter at KUOW. Good afternoon. This is KUOW's Bill Radke. President Obama endorsed Hillary Clinton for president today. No surprise, but a big step in Clinton's campaign. Now she and Obama will campaign together next week in Wisconsin. Obama also met with Bernie Sanders today. We're still waiting to see whether Sanders keeps campaigning into the July Democratic National Convention or whether he drops out earlier. And then one more note about the campaign. There was a rumor that Sanders was going to skydive into a rally in California, which he did not do. But two candidates for office here in Washington State did jump out of an airplane. KUOW's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins says it's another example of this non-traditional election year.
The occasion is a campaign kickoff event for Republican State Representative Drew McEwen. The location, the Shelton Airport. The special guest is Republican candidate for governor Bill Bryant. Shortly, both men will be boarding a plane to go skydiving. Turns out this was McEwen's idea, and he pitched it to Bryant.
Yeah, well, I think actually I hit him up a few months ago and said this was the plan for my kickoff, and do you want to jump? And caught him on a weak moment, and he said yes.
McEwen has done this once before. Bryant is a first-timer.
It's about 92 degrees right now, but have you had any cold feet?
No, I have not had any cold feet.
But still, why parachute out of an airplane for a campaign event? McEwen is quick with an answer.
Well, I think if there's any lesson right now with the 2016 elections, it's that it's not business as usual. And, you know, people get tired of the old stuff. And, yeah, I mean, this is a little bit of a splash. But, yeah, I mean, how many rubber chicken dinners can you ask people to go to? And, you know, just do something fun. And
yeah, I'm all over that. No more rubber chicken dinners.
Yeah. Bryant wants to use this event to highlight military ballots going out soon for the primary. But there's also a strategic reason for him doing this. Bryant's own campaign polling shows that as a first-time statewide candidate, he needs to get his name ID up with Washington voters. Then the moment arrives.
So as we send our jumpers off,
the candidates head out to meet their instructors, sign waivers, and get suited up to jump.
Is there room in there? Let's pile in.
This is probably a good place to pause and note that McEwen and Bryant both have opponents. And those opponents, for the record, have no plans to go skydiving anytime soon.
It's an interesting way to do a launch. It seems to be one way of doing it.
Craig Patty is a Democrat running against McEwen for state representative. He's also a firefighter, but he says there will be no thrill-seeking when he formally kicks off his campaign later this month.
I don't plan on taking people into burning buildings or doing a CPR demonstration or anything like that.
That includes getting tased, something another state rep candidate recently did. Patty says he's not convinced that campaign stunts really what it takes to break through in 2016.
I don't feel that if you have a good message that you need to be flashy to get it out there.
Bryant's opponent is Governor Jay Inslee. He may not deploy a parachute anytime soon, but he did recently deploy a fire shelter and climb inside it in front of TV cameras. Now, that was official governor business, not for the campaign. Asked if he's feeling any pressure to get creative on the campaign trail, Inslee doubles down on the power of incumbency.
We're doing our job, and my job today is to help people fight forest fires and prevent forest fires. I think that's pretty creative.
Back at the Shelton Airport, the candidates ride out to the airplane that will take them to 13,000 feet. I'm sitting next to McEwen.
Okay, so now you're about to really do this. What are you thinking?
The anxiety will hit when we're sitting in the door of the plane. But right now, I'm ready.
The plane arrives, picks them up, and a short while later, a video camera strapped to McEwen's chest captures the moment he and Bryant jump out of the plane attached to their instructors.
Here we go.
They free fall for about a minute before the parachutes are opened. A few minutes after that, they're back on the ground.
We brought them all back.
It's all high fives and smiles. Bryant is clearly stoked.
Ah, bully. It was just bully. It was great. Yeah, there was no part that I didn't enjoy.
I ask McEwen if this is going to help their campaigns.
Well, absolutely. You're here. Do you think it might bring in a few campaign contributions that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise? Because people have heard about this?
Absolutely.
As the candidates arrive back at the campaign kickoff event, there are some jokes.
The candidates are back after their stunt doubles jumped out of an airplane.
Then Bryant takes the mic.
Today, we didn't do the same thing. And we're demonstrating we're going to be thinking a little bit outside the box, and we're going to be taking a few risks.
After the speeches, a band strikes up.
30 days and 30 nights.
And soon, it starts to feel like a typical campaign event. There's music, pork sliders, and beer. I'm Austin Jenkins reporting.
It's so easy to...
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9, Seattle News and Information. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. When Seattle's David Bazan came out as an atheist, that was a shock to his Christian fans. Well, in his new album, Bazan sheds another identity, his identity of acoustic-only performer. Seattle DJ Marco Collins told me how Bazan has transformed over the years.
When I heard this song for the first time, which is called Both Hands, first song on the record, I was shocked because he sort of stepped in a whole different direction.
If I'm not losing sleep, I'm probably over it.
Tell us about David Bazan. And by the way, I think more of our listeners know him than they even maybe realize.
Yeah, he was started a group called Pedro the Lion that put out a record, well, several records back in 1997. When I first heard Pedro the Lion, I was working at the End at the time, and I just thought, wow, I haven't heard someone create these kind of songs on an indie level that are that cohesive. I mean, like hooks for days, and hooks with depth to them too.
Inches.
I feel like they were a national hit. Am I wrong, Pedro the Lion?
Yeah, they were a national hit with a young Christian sort of crowd. And
yeah.
I remember when I was playing them, folks would say to me, why are you playing a Christian band? And I thought, come on, I play Marilyn Manson. Why wouldn't I also embrace what was going on the Christmas?
The full religious spectrum.
Absolutely.
Just that phrase, by the way, indie Christian band.
That's a big deal.
First I'd ever heard of that. A few years ago, he came out with this record that was sort of called his breakup letter,
yeah.
Breaking Up With God.
Yeah. Curse Your Branches was the name of the album. And if you're a Bazan fan, that is your favorite record. I've heard that from so many people. I love the record. Lyrically, you can read it right out of the gate.
Wait just a minute. You expect me to believe that.
He released this record and thought, nobody's going to like this record. Everybody's going to hate it. And people did hate it. When it came out, his following started walking away from him. but he reached an entirely new audience by being that truthful.
Sounds like he struggled with it, though, too.
He did struggle with it, as I think a lot of people do. You know, a lot of people struggle with the idea that, you know, there might be no God.
So in his new music, you said it's way more electronic.
It's way more electronic. There's an individual that produced the record named Yuki, and he's from a group called Crystal Skulls. So the new album almost has a feel, an M83 feel. You know the band M83. Mm-hmm. Just very atmospheric, very beautiful, sonic in a quiet way.
I love this music. I love the moodiness of it. Personally, it reminds me of stuff I used to listen to when I was first snowboarding.
Okay.
You'd get up way early, you know, it
yeah.
was dark, and you were going to have some kind of adventure, and I just wanted to put myself in some otherworldly place.
Cinematic. I mean, it's
cinematic.
Really cinematic, and that description right there, going snowboarding, like the mountains and everything about that experience, totally makes the music that much more intense to me.
Is David Bazan playing around the Seattle area?
He is. Tomorrow night he's playing the Neptune, which is unusual for him. David and his manager have reinvented touring in a way. They tour and do house shows around the country. So, you know, you have to sign up, you have to audition, or not really audition, you have to apply
uh-huh.
to be one of the places he plays. And they kind of...
Literally in your house?
Literally in your house. People will come to your home, they buy tickets, and they come to watch the show. And the way David described it a couple of years ago was, some of the shows you walk into, and it's like five people in a kitchen. Other shows, you've got 250 people out on the back patio. You know, so he's had a lot of success sort of redefining touring for the independent artist.
What's another song you want to share?
Well, the other song that I really loved from this record is a song called Trouble with Boys. And it's, again, one of those tracks that, you know, emotionally you feel it just through the music.
All your trouble.
Trouble with Boys. What do you think that's about?
You know, I don't know, and I wouldn't sort of guess. I do know that I can identify with that title and identify with the lyrics, and I think probably a good chunk of the population can also identify with those lyrics. That's all I can really say about that one.
Marco Collins bringing you some Seattle music. This from David Bazan, whose new album is out now. It's called Blanco, and he's going to be performing tomorrow night at Seattle's Neptune Theater. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9. Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Across the Pacific Northwest today and all this week, emergency responders have been holding a drill. They are testing out how they're going to handle things when the big earthquake hits. And as you've heard, it's not if, it's when. KUOW's economy reporter Carolyn Adolph says one big challenge is going to be getting supplies through downtown Seattle.
I-5 is our main route through downtown, but after a magnitude 9 earthquake, the State Transportation Department says that section is unlikely to be standing. There's a workaround. It's called Highway 99. It's part of what WashDOT calls its seismic lifeline. Even a lifeline is going to face challenges, so we went to find out what some of them would be. Imagine picking up a load from Boeing Field and delivering it to people in Fremont. I asked Professor Tom Heaton of Caltech what we might encounter.
I work on understanding the physics of earthquakes and also the physics of buildings in earthquakes.
Now, imagine he's in the back seat. Heaton has made a study of Seattle's prospects since 1982, and he's been thinking...
Oh, this could be really bad.
Morning after a big quake, everybody's taking care of themselves for now.
Yeah, they're trying to figure out how their lives work, how they're going to get food and water, how to repair things that have gone wrong in their homes.
So no commute then the next day to work, right?
Definitely no commute to work.
That leaves the roads to the emergency responders. And we're on Highway 99 near Boeing Field, heading north towards Seattle. Earthquake maps show that this section south of the city lies in a liquefaction zone. Professor Heaton.
The soil turns into a mud slurry that just starts to ooze downhill.
If you were to attempt to drive over a highway where there's been liquefaction...
The forces from the soil will just overwhelm the strength of the asphalt.
We might need to detour onto side streets. Good thing this is an SUV. Our next big hurdle would be downtown's southern doorstep. This is where we are either facing the Alaskan Way Viaduct, which we all know would be a bad thing, or the tunnel. But Heaton says the tunnel isn't a sure thing either.
Of course, there are cases where the ground liquefies and the... say a tunnel might have some failures in it. Just because it's new doesn't mean that it will be fine in an earthquake.
Still, the tunnel is a better bet than surface streets for getting our supplies through downtown. Heaton's lab has modeled it.
If the earthquake gets close to Seattle, we saw ground motions that would potentially collapse relatively modern high-rise construction. We expect them to more likely fall over sideways, just kind of folded over.
Taking out power and sewer lines as they fall.
It wouldn't be nice.
But let's imagine there is a tunnel. We use it and we make it. Then one final barrier, the Aurora Bridge. Built in the 1930s, infamously narrow, and another seismic lifeline question mark. Tom Heaton, however, gives the thumbs up.
Just because it's old doesn't mean that it won't do well in an earthquake.
Fremont at last. Mission accomplished. But our passenger is unimpressed.
Let's suppose you got your supplies through and you delivered them. Now you've given everybody food and water for the next couple of days, but they still have to put everything back together again, and that's going to take decades.
Sounds like we're going to need more than a seismic lifeline to get through this. In Seattle, I'm Carolyn Adolph, KUOW News.
Speaking of our roads, Uber's driving in Bremerton again. Yesterday I told you the company had quit that town because of onerous regulations. Bremerton doesn't make rideshare companies follow all of its taxicab rules, but it does require a $75 business license, and Uber had said that was a problem. But after talking with the city attorney's office, Uber officials say they changed their minds, and now their drivers can pick up fares in Bremerton again, beginning today. It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Here in Seattle, we really like debating things. Should we build a monorail? Back and forth, back and forth. What about the waterfront tunnel? Long debate. More light rail. Well, how come some major, big-ticket decisions barely get debated at all? For example, a $1.4 billion plan to expand the Washington State Convention Center downtown. Here's KUOW reporter David Hyde.
It's the day before the third annual Seattle Pet Expo. Thousands of pet lovers and their pets are expected to attend. Exhibitors are here setting up and getting ready. And Fernandez is showing off the automatic ball launcher from a company called PetSafe.
He goes running after it, picks it up, and then hopefully brings it back and puts it back in. And you have hours of fun tiring out your dog while you sit on the porch having a glass of wine.
The Pet Expo is just one of around 350-plus events that take place at the Washington State Convention Center every year. But convention center backers say that's not good enough. Their plan is to roughly double in size to bring in more convention center business. The idea is to build a new addition near the existing center. It's an 8-acre chunk of land across the street from the Paramount Theater. Currently, it's the site of Convention Place bus station, which is scheduled to close for light rail expansion.
Besides our ability to help the convention center and basically generate the tourist traffic, it's a chance to fill in this hole and create a great pedestrian link to the various neighborhoods.
Matt Griffin is project manager. He says the addition reflects new thinking on how convention centers can be woven into the urban landscape.
The conventioners will be able to see out, will be able to understand that they're in a city, they're not in the middle of a cornfield, as well as for people on the outside to be able to look in and see the activity of what's going on the inside. And at night, it will actually be illuminated and glow more like a jewel box than a big empty box like many convention centers.
But the bigger goal is to compete for more business. And Griffin says the addition alone will attract tens of thousands of out-of-state convention goers who are forecast to spend around $200 million a year. And all of that spending will bring in thousands of new jobs. But critics say we've heard these rosy predictions before. Haywood Sanders is a professor at the University of Texas at San Antonio who studies convention centers. And he says back in the 1990s, the convention center here also wanted to roughly double in size. And at the time, the experts said that that would almost double the number of conventions.
That expansion went ahead, but the results proved a little different than center promoters had anticipated.
The boom in business from out-of-state visitors never materialized. Even last year, long after Seattle had recovered from two recessions. And Seattle's not alone. Sanders says part of the problem now is that cities all over the country and all over Washington State have overbuilt convention space, mostly fueled by bad advice.
Lots of the consultant studies that say expand your convention center and you'll see a big increase in business simply have never worked out. That should raise some serious questions in the mind of the public about whether this kind of investment really makes any sense.
Seattle urban designer David Dahl shares these doubts, especially given the $1.4 billion price tag.
Three times the seawall replacement, more than the Move Seattle levy that was on the ballot last November. And it's in the mega project range. And it's something that I think a lot of people in Seattle are a little wary of at the moment.
Dahl describes convention centers as dead zones, lifeless areas that might produce another cheesecake factory, but don't add to the vibrancy of Seattle's urban environment. But his biggest beef is with how little debate or public scrutiny there's been so far.
They've gone a very long way through this process without ever having any kind of comprehensive discussion of it in the public realm. So there have been certain pieces of it, like design review and the environmental impact statement that come up, but they've never had to come before the city of Seattle and say, is this something you want? Is this something you really need? We think it is, and here's why.
A lot of times, Seattle's all about the process. So why is the convention center here seemingly outside of that? I put the question to project manager Matt Griffin.
I don't know if there's been a debate about whether or not they want this convention center. I would say in all of our public meetings, in our EIS, et cetera, we haven't had many comments about whether or not to build it. It's always been about the questions about when you build it, what aspects should it have.
For the monorail, for Sound Transit 3, for the Seattle levy, which is actually cheaper than this project, there is a debate, there is a public conversation. Why is this not a part of that same kind of public process here in Seattle?
We're not asking the citizens of Seattle to basically vote for a new tax. This is a tax that the hoteliers had already decided to place on their own customers. And so the people in Seattle aren't being asked to invest their money.
And the hotel tax is different from other taxes. A big percentage of it goes to the convention center to spend how it sees fit. Convention center expert Haywood Sanders sees it this way.
It's a charming notion. I give a great deal of credit to hotel and lodging interests in King County and to their counterparts around the country who managed to make the argument that hotel tax dollars are theirs, in some sense, to do as they choose, and not public dollars that the public should have some say in.
Some other cities do handle their hotel taxes differently. In San Francisco, for instance, almost all hotel tax revenue goes directly into the general fund. And that means lawmakers decide, not hotel business leaders or the convention center, how that money gets spent. I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
Now, the convention center expansion project still faces final reviews. Later this year, the city council will vote on whether to give public streets and alleys over to the project. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In the news today, President Obama has announced his formal endorsement of Hillary Clinton in an online video. Obama calls on Democrats to unify behind his former Secretary of State and to build on the progress of his 8 years in the White House.
I want those of you who've been with me from the beginning of this incredible journey to be the first to know that I'm with her. I am fired up, and I cannot wait to get out there and campaign for Hillary.
And they're going to get at it next week. Clinton and Obama on the campaign trail in Green Bay, Wisconsin next week. Obama also had kind words for Bernie Sanders, praising Sanders for engaging young voters and highlighting the issues of income inequality and money in politics. Obama said embracing that message is going to help us win in November. You're listening to KUOW Seattle. Now I want you to meet Feza Sultan, born in Iraqi Kurdistan. She worked as a translator for NGOs until one morning when Saddam Hussein's troops entered her city. They were there to kill anybody affiliated with Americans. Feza and thousands of others were evacuated by the U.S. military. She found political asylum in Seattle in 1997. Feza Sultan is still working as a translator. She's also a poet. And she told KUOW's Elizabeth Austin how her life affects her poetry.
To be a poet, it means that you look at the world and you look at your surrounding very differently. It's not your choice. You're born like that. And what's going on in the Middle East, and especially in Iraq, is very, you can just see it in my poems. I live with them. I live with the victims. They live with me. I woke up with them. They woke up with me. And they are in every line of my poems. I decided, or they decided, some way I became the voice of the victims of Iraq.
Your second collection of poetry, I Am a Visitor on This Earth, was translated from Arabic into English by a Seattle-based poet, Lina Khalaf Tufaha, who joins us now in the studio. Lina, I understand that after meeting Faiza at a panel on Arabic poetry, you began translating some poems that Faiza had posted on Facebook and eventually asked if you could translate this new collection. Why did you want to bring Faiza's poems into English?
I was so moved when I read Faiza's poetry, and her poetry is very much like the person that she is. It's powerful, and it's determined, and it's deeply tender. And I love that combination, and I just don't think there is enough of the voice of Arab women in English poetry, and I think Faiza's is a special voice, so I was excited about the opportunity to share it.
Faiza, could we hear you read one of your poems, please?
Sure, with pleasure. ليلة أمس ليلة أمس خرجت من رأسي فراشة كبيرة أجنحتها خضراء من ورق الأشجار ثم خرج أطفال كثر
Last night, out of my head emerged a large butterfly, wings green as the leaves of trees. Then children emerged, so many, blood-stained, chasing after it. My mother was pleased with her dead brother's visit, and I was busy replacing destroyed cities on the shelves and receiving the dispersed in my home, the dispersed resting against old crucifixes. Last night, my soul left me and returned this morning, wounded, with dead I do not know, but they knew me.
That was Last Night from I Am a Visitor on This Earth, read in the original Arabic by Faiza Sultan and in the English translation by Lina Khalaf Tufaha. When we were talking a moment ago, you talked about poets being people who see the world differently. Is this what you mean as the way you see the world differently?
I do. And I see the world, in spite of all this ugliness and all this war around the world, I do see the essence of our existence, the beauty of our existence and the beauty around us in every single moment, in every single details. I try to live it. I try to live the beauty around us in nature, in the smile of a human being, a stranger that I don't know, or maybe I know in another world. I try to fight ugliness through beauty, and I think poets can do that.
Lena, thank you for translating Feiss's work and reading it for us. I know you grew up here in Seattle and also in Jordan and other countries in the Middle East, so you've both had lives that are shaped by crossing these international borders. What do you each hope that these acts of translation that you're both engaged in, what do you hope that these acts of translation across borders of language and culture, what do you hope that accomplishes?
I think for me, I want to just provide a richer vocabulary of human experience to share. There is so much that we have in common and that we share as human beings, and Feiss's poetry really expresses that. But there are also, you know, unique experiences that we have in our own home countries that we can learn about and that can grow our spirits. There's enormous opportunity for empathy. And I think that when you hear a voice like Feiss's, you are reminded about just the resilience of the human spirit, but also the ways in which we can connect. And I think, you know, the more that we reach out in translation, you know, the more opportunities we have to share those experiences.
Feiss, what do you hope that a listener will get from hearing your poems?
Poetry is the language of soul, and it's the soul who's talking. For me, if people like what I write, it means they like the voices of the victims around the world, especially in the Middle East. I want them to accept and go through the deep side of what's going on in the Middle East and what is beyond the news footage that they see. Those are real people with real family, with real dreams, children like your children. And I hope that will ignite something inside them and the awareness to change what's going on in the world. And we all hope that peace one day will be our goal.
Talking with KUOW's Elizabeth Austin, that's Seattle poet Feiss's Sultan. She founded a local publishing house dedicated to translating literature and academic texts from Arabic into English. Poet and translator Lena Khalaf Tufaha is a Seattle native of Palestinian, Jordanian, and Syrian heritage. Her first book of poems, Water and Salt, will be published in 2017. And you can hear Lena Khalaf Tufaha reading some of her own poetry at our website, KUOW.org. Finally, you're going to hear another kind of poet tomorrow on KUOW because Louisville, Kentucky hosts a public celebration of the life of the rhyming fighter Muhammad Ali. We're going to bring you live coverage of that beginning at 11 o'clock tomorrow. If you want to hear our Friday Week in Review show, you can stream it live on KUOW's mobile app. You can also hear it live at 12:06 tomorrow on KUOW2 on HD3, your HD radio. And, of course, you can get the Week in Review podcast. Listen whenever you want on your favorite podcast app. At the 1976 Montreal Olympics, the American women's swim team arrived expecting to collect victory after victory after victory. Then they saw the East German swim team.
These East German women came out of nowhere. Their times dropped by dozens of seconds in less than a year.
And for the American women's swim team, the Montreal Olympics turned into a story of defeat after defeat after defeat. That is, until the freestyle relay, the very last race. Has just beat East Germany. I can still remember that moment in 1976. And our guest today, Wendy Bolio, lives in Western Washington. She was part of that team. She's featured in a new documentary about the race called The Last Gold, the greatest untold story in Olympic swimming history. Wendy joined us to talk about what happened 40 years ago this summer and how it changed her life. Wendy Beaulieu, welcome to The Record.
Bill, thank you so much for having me.
Wendy, I remember those Olympics as a child, and I watched with misty eyes, watched again that final race. The American women's swimming team came into those Olympics with a lot of high hopes, and the expectations were a victory. Your teammate, Shirley Babashoff, I remember that name so well. She was like a sort of a Michael Phelps figure, this amazing swimmer. She was just going to get gold after gold after gold. Then what happened?
You know, very first day, I watched Shirley Babashoff, Kim Payton, and Jill Sterkel stand up on the blocks in the final of the 100-meter freestyle race, individual race. They were all American record holders at one time. Shirley had been a world record holder in that 100 freestyle individual event. And watch these women take fourth, fifth, and seventh place. And they didn't lose by tenths of a second from the three East German women. They were half a body length, full body lengths ahead of not only us, who were the epitome of U.S. women swimming in the world, to what happened. And that very first day, you went, yep, we're not in Kansas anymore. This is a whole different ballgame.
What did you make of that East German women's team?
23 women. I think the most astounding thing to me was if in comparison with our United States women's swimming team, we averaged age was 16 years old. I was 21, married. But we all had different body types. Little Nicole Kramer from the U.S., 800 freestyle swimmer. She's 5'2", you know, 110 pounds. I'm 6 feet tall, 138 pounds, and everything in between. East German women swimmers were all the same. They were built all the same. They were 5'8", 5'9", about 160 to 175 pounds. Big women, big women. And I'm a pretty big gal. Very muscular. So right away when you saw them, you went, oh, man, how are they swimming and training so much differently than us to be that fast? Never occurred to me that, hey, they're on stuff. There were rumors about that, Bill, but there was no proof of that.
Did you say anything about what you seeing?
Oh, yeah. I was very vocal because I was ticked off. I mean, and articles came out in the paper. Shirley was called Surly Shirley because she criticized there's something wrong. They've got to be on some kind of performance-enhancing drugs, which at the time was just called steroids. There's no way these women are faster than any of us, including me, meaning Shirley saying that. And I said the same thing. I mean, we were really vocal.
To reporters?
Oh, to everybody. When I came out of my 100-meter butterfly with a bronze medal, an American record, around my neck, and the media, U.S. media, this isn't European media, but my own U.S. media saying, boy, you really got beat. What's going on with the United States women that they're getting beat? And, you know, we heard that every day, all day long.
So you're getting tired of being asked about losing, and so you're telling people, this is crooked. How did people react to you saying that?
Same as the media. You know, we came back from winning an Olympic gold medal, the only gold we won that year, that whole week long, and we didn't come back to a parade. We didn't come back to... God, we went through the airport and people pointing at us and going, bad sports, poor sports.
Because you had dared speak up and say that they're cheating.
Yeah. Articles were written. I mean, articles in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, everywhere in the country that went for about 6 months after we got back from Montreal saying what poor sports we were and these poor East German women. They just trained harder and were just better than you. How ashamed we are to have you as American swimmers. I mean, that's what we came back to. And interestingly enough, all those years later after the wall came down and all the information was out there, interesting, Bill, I haven't received one apologetic letter from any writer or any person who sent me those personal notes, you know, and articles.
You've said that you're 61 years old.
Please stop saying that.
No, okay, never again. I'll take that back. You seem healthy and vigorous to me. Do you know how your health compares with your East German competitors?
Yeah, I went back to East Germany. Well, it was Germany. 8 years ago and did it was part of a documentary called Doping for Gold. And so I had the opportunity to interview a lot of the athletes and several of the ones that I competed in Montreal with. And because of the doping that they did, and keep in mind, Bill, they were given these drugs at 11, 12, 13-year-old little girls that altered the way that their body looked and changed from their voice, as simple as their voice, to hair on their bodies, to muscles, to all of that, to swim really, really fast. And then you see them today in the health issues that they have, cancers that weren't even identified 8 years ago by our standards. Their children with club feet, the amount of autism, all of that. I mean, not only their health, but their kids' health. And get this, it's their grandchildren's health too. Because these women that I competed against are about my age. They've had kids who now have had kids. So it's a linear line of their health, and it is not good. It is not good.
I'm talking with Wendy Beaulieu, who was part of the U.S. women's swimming team at the 76th Olympics in Montreal. The American women went to Montreal at the top of their game, fully expecting to be champions. Then they met the swimmers from East Germany, who we've since learned were systematically doped by their government without their knowledge. That was suspected but not proven back in 1976. Wendy, you were in the middle of that controversy as the competition was going on. How did that affect your state of mind as you were competing?
I loved competing. I mean, I grew up, I'm one of seven children. You compete every day in a family of seven, right? So, and I was such a good swimmer younger. And so I had the benefit of having my parents coach me. My father had gone 4 years through World War II as a tank driver. I mean, I had stories in my head that he had told all of us kids. So competition was, it was just what we did. And to me, I loved nothing more than standing on the block knowing that I was the best in the world. And the only way I could be beaten was, you're just going to have to show me. So I honestly couldn't wait to get up there. I really couldn't.
That's fantastic.
I really couldn't.
So you wanted it. I want to talk about this big race, the final race again, 76 Olympics. Your team, you know, this is your chance.
Yeah.
The team has been down. So put me on that block with you. Up to that moment in your life, what had you done to become a champion swimmer?
Growing up in Wisconsin, Land O'Lakes, Wisconsin, my parents were my coaches. Father knew nothing at all about swimming, but he read everything. My mother had been a competitive swimmer until she was 27 years old. One of seven kids. We all had to be athletes in some fashion, baseball, my brother's football, that kind of thing. My younger sister Lori and I found that, God, at swimming, I just loved it. I breathed it. I loved it. I loved the minute I got in the water to this day. And I swim 3-4 times a week. To this day, I love that feeling of just being in the water and then to swim fast. I mean, I trained 15 years in a little 17-yard-long pool in a hotel. My mother.
In a hotel?
Little hotel pool in Land O'Lakes, Wisconsin, town of 600 people. The closest 25 and 50 meter pool was an hour and a half away. So my mother, you know, I think the thing for my mom and for us kids was my parents found opportunity when nobody thought that there was any. And she looked at the 17 yard long pool that she was a lifeguard at and went, you know, I can teach them all to swim and I can get them in the pool. And who knows, maybe we'll put together a little swimming team here in this little town. And won't that be great? But I think she recognized very early on that my younger sister and I loved it and we were strong. And, you know, there was a point when I was about 11 or 12 that my father, who was an electrical engineer, decided a couple things. She needed more training than just this little 17-yard long pool. Great at the flip turns, but, you know, basically you get four strokes and you're at the end and you flip. So he designed a harness that went around my chest. It cabled up to the ceiling of this indoor hotel pool, went over to the side of the pool, cabled down the side of the pool, and he had a plate loading stack of weights. So I could swim in place. So if you picture that, I could swim in place without ever having to do a flip turn. I could go for hours. I used to go for hours. And as I got stronger and got closer to the edge of the pool, he would just put another 5-pound plate on. And that's how I trained for 6 more years. He loved being able to put put us in the lake, which was a mile from our home, because then we could, I mean, when you're on a tether like that, your stroke does change. So in the summertime, in middle of May, he and I would walk out and we'd pound a new starting block in, and he had a little lane line, and he marked it off for 50 meters, and that's how I trained. I mean, that just, I just couldn't wait to swim. When you got people like that behind you, I couldn't wait.
So back to this amazing race.
Yeah.
I want to play a little clip.
Okay.
So you're getting ready for the race. This is what the audience at home was hearing.
Four times 100-meter freestyle relay. The world record, of course, held by the fantastic East German women. 3 minutes, 48.80.
But you're not watching TV. You're there standing at the edge of that pool. And what's going through your mind?
To me, Bill, there was no way I'm coming out of there without a gold medal. There's just absolutely no way.
This is the final race.
If I have to cough up a lung to do it, I don't care. That's what's going on. And we all had that same attitude. We were ticked off. We were mad. We were, hey, it probably was going to be the last Olympics that I was ever going to have, as well as my teammates. So we each four of us were put in that position. I mean, we were determined.
The American team got this one gold medal.
Mm-hmm.
You got your bronze. But how do you feel about the medals that you didn't win?
Well, we know. We know. I mean, Shirley knows she's got five goals. And until the IOC, which doesn't have to do anything. It's its own entity. It's its own little world. It's its own club. They set the rules. They make the rules. They break the rules. It's their deal. They're never going to change that.
How can you possibly be okay with that?
Look, it's never fair. Life is not fair. Sports is not fair. And my attitude is, I just got to keep moving on. And if I had taken the attitude of being very negative out of Montreal and, oh, poor us, poor us, honestly, it'd be hard to get out of bed in the morning. Life deals you all kinds of stuff. And I think one of the greatest values that I came out of Montreal with, and it's just reinforced it over the years, is, God, I was so lucky. I was so fortunate to be a part of something so great and actually come out with a medal. But I learned so much through sport. And one of the things I learned right off the bat is life's not fair. It served me well in my life. It has served me well. It doesn't make me not trust people or institutions or companies or presidential candidates. It just makes me go, you know what? Life sucks sometimes, and you just got to step up and make it the best that you can. And that's certainly what I do, my husband does, our kids do, and that's a legacy that I want to pass on to my family.
Wendy Beaulieu lives in Sammamish now. She was part of the 76th Olympic swimming team that's now featured in a new documentary called The Last Gold, the greatest untold story in Olympic swimming history. There's a great YouTube video of that race. We're tweeting it out right now at KUOW. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Thanks for tuning in.